You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hi, I'm Jack. I live in East Gippsland in Victoria. And the truth is that it's really hard to introduce myself because we've only been fairly recently diagnosed with DID. We're only fairly recently aware of all of this. So I've lived most of my life with almost like a half self or a pretend persona that we all kind of unknowingly took on to present a seamless or an apparently seamless self to the rest of the world and to ourselves. So that we didn't know we had DID. So it's actually at the moment a process of, I'm kind of in the very beginning stages of a process of trying to get to know my own self. So I guess what I know about myself is that I love to read, I love to write, I love language. And everything feels pretty new.
Yeah, that's lovely. And I think that's like perfectly fine. And like, I think the common story for DID is that most people don't realize it until they're an adult. I didn't realize it till I was 25, I think. I'm 30 now. Generally there's like an event in life. It's not always the case for everyone, but usually there's a very challenging event in life that leads to a bit of an unraveling that starts to make an awareness of the DID. And that's what we talked about last year. And I think everyone's at their different like places and understandings with it. And I guess one of the things that what you just said made me think about is that it can be quite an existentially confronting thing to start to realize this, what's going on, what's happening in the mind with this stuff and identity and all that.
Exactly. For us, like that's one of the things that's been really challenging and that we, you know, comes up over and over again in therapy. You know, if you think about it, like a lot of movies and TV shows that are going for an aspect of like existential horror will use this kind of setup where suddenly a person's confronted by the fact that there's stuff going on in their mind and that their identity isn't what they thought it was and their whole world falls apart. Like I think Star Trek did it multiple times with different characters being cloned and what does that mean that there's two of me or, you know, or finding out that they have some alien whatever living within their, you know, shared experience within. And it's like this, there's this recurring theme in fiction around the existential horror of not knowing oneself. And for us that was and has been and continues to be an enormous struggle on top of everything else. It's like I guess because most people can, you know, can confidently say they know themselves. And we've been dragged into a place where we have to acknowledge that we don't know ourselves. Like, you know, sometimes I've had somebody, you know, if I've been in a bit of conflict with somebody, not intense, but a little bit of conflict, and there's a discussion about, well, you said this, and they'll say, I didn't say that. I don't remember the conversation, but I know I didn't say that because that's not something I would say. I know that that's not something I would say. And like for us, it's like we feel like that even that certainty has been taken away. Like I might know that I wouldn't say that, but maybe one of us did. You know, it's anyway, it's challenging.
Yeah. And then it's also, it changes the dynamics in your relationships. It's quite like on a relational level with other people in your life, it makes it all quite new territory. And I've talked with other people who are quite similar to myself and my cohort of people in my head, that there's a lot of masking and work we do to just try and sort of make it easier with other people. But there is, how has it affected your relationships in life?
Well, actually, the crisis, oh, well, it wasn't a crisis event, but we're also autistic, and like many autistic people who are undiagnosed, and even actually a lot of diagnosed autistic people, we hit around 45, kind of hit that intense autistic burnout and suddenly just could not function at all. And basically dropped everything in our lives. And so I guess the result of that was like that lasted, well, we're only just coming out of it now, so 6 or 7 years. And through that process, actually, we just don't really have people in our life. And then we've moved to the country from the city alone. And so I guess I don't know what it would have done to existing relationships, but I know that it makes forming new relationships quite challenging. Even though we're fully open about having DID and being autistic, so there's never any ambiguity around people not understanding what's going on, but they don't get it. Like, you can tell somebody something, that doesn't mean they understand it.
Both those things come with an immense amount of myths and stigma, autism and DID.
Yeah, absolutely. I was at a writing retreat on the weekend, and a situation arose where I ended up telling the 8 or 9 people I was sitting with that I have DID. And, well, actually it was a different one of us, but anyway, she told them about it. It was Beatrice. And she told them about it, and somebody said something about, you know, it was received really well, but someone said something about, and of course it's nothing like the stereotypes you see on TV and stuff. And I said, yeah, there is no serial killer. You're safe. I'm not going to kill you. And somebody jokingly said, yes, but that's exactly what the serial killer would say, right? You know, so it was good that they could joke about it and that there was that awareness because of the particular group it was. But certainly other people that I've told, they've said like, oh, is that like, and they'll name a movie that's like horrific representation. Yeah. Like, yes and no. It's nothing like that.
And so this year's theme is navigating medical systems. I'm just curious, as a person with autism or as an autistic person, I'm not sure which way around you prefer that. I know autistic person. As an autistic person, do you find, have you already been engaged with medical services or therapeutic supports?
I guess the largest engagement we've had was the actual diagnosis process for both things. And so we started seeing a therapist 3 years ago who's a clinical social worker. And she very quickly recognized that we had DID, even though we didn't know, because she's very skilled at it and she, you know, works with it. And then over a 6-month period, she also began to question whether we were autistic.
Right.
And both of those things we fought her tooth and nail on, just insisting she was wrong.
Can I ask why?
Well, we didn't have the classic, you know, like when you read the DSM about DID, we didn't, like, we don't experience daily amnesia around, like, we never have the experience of, I don't remember putting that there, or where did this go, or any of those things. Like, when we did the dissociation, whatever scale thing it is, we didn't really register as having significant dissociation. And that's possibly, again, like, there's this overlap between dissociation and autism, like trauma and autism. So I think both things were masking each other, because we also don't have a lot of stereotypical autistic traits, or at least we didn't know that we did at the time, because we were masking very strongly. So eventually the therapist arranged for us to have, you know, with our consent, of course, to see a psychiatrist to get formal diagnoses of both those things once, well, for us, we were thinking we were going there to prove her wrong. but we agreed that, you know, we'd go and just find out, we'd ask someone else what they thought. and the psychiatrist was very bad. He had no experience of autism at all. And no insight into the way that that assessment process might be affected by DID, because he accepted straight away that we have DID. Apparently it's very clear to everybody else. But then he gave us an assessment for autism that assumed that there was one person doing it, one identity doing it. So, you know, like it said things like, do you have problem, you know, do you find this, like say, do you find it difficult when something can't be done the way that you thought it was going to be done? And the answer for that is different for all of us. I mean, some of us are 5 years old, some of us are 3 years old, some of us are, like, I'm 16, some are 23. It's like, you know, it's not a question that none of the questions on the assessment had an easy, straightforward answer, given the dissociation and the multiple selves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was just very disheartening. And so he decided we weren't autistic because we didn't get the right number on his little tick sheet. So then our therapist arranged for us to see a psychologist who is herself autistic. And she was very aware of dissociation in general and trauma stuff. But had, I think, no experience of working with people with DID, or maybe one time, I can't remember. But she was absolutely fantastic. Like right from the beginning, she just said, like, you take the lead in terms of what terminology I should use. Tell me what I'm getting wrong. Tell me what I'm missing. And we had 3 appointments with her, and she was so respectful and so intelligent around, like, thinking into what might be different for someone with DID who's autistic than for non-DID people who are autistic. And so she decided quite decisively that yes, we're autistic and have ADHD. So that was a really positive process, I guess.
And I suppose that that's one of those things with that's come up in a number of conversations I've done for this broadcast, is that so much about getting the help you need or getting the diagnosis, whatever it is that you're seeking help for, is about having a safe space and a space for you to tell your story in the way that's comfortable for you without this maybe more like prescriptive, analytical, rigid by the book kind of thinking, like the DSM, which DSM is so notorious for being just such a checklist of, you know, what even does identity confusion mean when it's listed as one of the things in the DSM with DID? What does, like, how do you know if you have amnesia if you don't remember?
I remember my therapist said, like, when she was trying to help us understand what was going on, and we wouldn't believe it, she said, you know, how often do you have the experience of when you're out in the world and someone thinks that they know you, but you are like, no, you've mistaken me for someone else? It's like, oh, well, all the time, but everybody has that. You know, everybody experiences that all the time. And she was like, I have literally never had somebody mistake me for someone else. I was like, oh, how, you know, like, but you do think that your normal is everybody's normal.
Absolutely. I had a dream the other week where I went out and I watered the yard, and I got all this muck on the watering can. And then I was going about my day and realized that it wasn't a dream, and realized that I had done it straight from like getting out of bed. And my first thought was like, "Oh, guys, did we put clothes on? Were we in the bath? Were we in the backyard? Did the neighbors see us? Like, what's going on?"
Yes, I had a similar experience. We thought we were sleepwalking and we were living in this inner city apartment. So there were like security cameras in the corridor and stuff outside our apartment. And we woke up one morning and the door was unlocked and partially open, which is something we would never have just accidentally left it that way. And yeah, it was like, well, I don't sleep in anything. Did someone get up and go for a walk in the night?
That was going back to this year's topic. So it sounds like you've got a wonderful social worker helping with you, and that space being created for you is so important. So what is space useful for in therapeutic settings? What does good space to you look like, and how does it help you?
I think the most important thing, well, the most important thing that comes to mind for me around that is the way that she doesn't, and like right from the start, she didn't really present us with like a model to understand DID. She didn't present us with specific terminology. I mean, obviously, she had to use terminology to talk to us about it, but she kept it very loose. And so she wasn't like, oh yes, dissociative, DID is a strategy that blah blah, like some of the explanations people have around why someone has DID. She was just like, hey, there's more than one of you. And so in the first year and a half or so of that process, she gave us the space to work out how we understand our experience and what terminology makes sense for us and how we make sense of the experiences that we have. And she follows our lead there. So we don't, like, for example, we talk about having different selves. I know other people might say they have different parts, or they might say they have alters, and all of those are valid. However someone talks about their thing is valid. It's their reality. And so she made space for that, for our reality, and helped us to struggle through working out how to do that. It went through lots of different iterations of trying to make sense of all of this. And like similarly, because she didn't present us with like this is the structural model of dissociation or whatever, we discovered for ourselves that we don't now and never have had a main self or a real self, and we have always been incredibly fluid in shifting, mid-conversation, often mid-sentence sometimes, and that is our normal, and it would have been, I can only imagine how damaging it would have been or how limiting it would have been if we'd happened to have a therapist who insisted on telling us what our condition was and how it worked and how we should understand it or make sense of it. Because then we'd have been trying to like mold ourselves into what we were supposed to be. Yes, in like response to the DSM's ridiculous arbitrary definitions. Yeah, because I've talked to people with DID who've said like their therapist refuses to talk to any of them except the one that she's decided is the real one. And like,
Oh,
how
that's not
harmful
good.
is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so yeah, I think for us, space is in therapy is mostly around not just allowing, but supporting us to find our own way, both to understand ourselves and to work through our trauma and our struggles with DID.
And does your therapist, mine is quite careful about how she pokes and prods around in our mind, you know, it's her job to ask certain questions and to explore certain things, but our mind is a minefield when it comes to traumatic memory and feelings of the different, I call them my headmates. how does your therapy look when it comes to poking and prodding around? Do you have systems of communication? Like how do you go about it? How does your therapist go about it with you, I should say?
Yeah, I would say that she has always had us almost entirely in the lead. Like she rarely will say, hey, I think we need to come back to this, or I think we need to talk about this. In fact, almost never. So she just works with whoever turns up on the day. We do make agreements. Like at the moment, one of the younger ones is kind of consistently working with our therapist twice a week on specific on processing a specific trauma event. And then we have a third day. We've just started having three sessions a week instead of two, which I know is an incredible luxury. And so that third session as of last week is going to allow the rest of us to kind of check in and maintain a relationship with our therapist, because although we're really grateful for the trauma processing that's being done, we were finding that the rest of us were feeling a bit abandoned and disconnected from our therapist because we weren't talking to her for extended periods of time.
We've been really privileged as well to have a therapist who, whatever we can afford, has tried to see us every week. We moved from Sydney to Melbourne years ago, and she just continued to see us via telehealth. And while that has some limitations, it's been so important for our stability, our health and well-being to keep seeing her. And sorry, mind slipping for a moment.
You're good. I get it.
You touched on something there, which is we are people who have suffered some significant trauma. We need consistent therapy. Could you tell me a little bit about you know, why it's important that you get like consistent therapy? Because one of the points I've raised in this broadcast is that there's no Medicare recognition for there really is nothing in the Medicare allowance to specifically say people with complex trauma or dissociative disorders should get more Medicare, even though there are mental health conditions that do get you extra sessions. And it's something that I think could be a really good starting point for people living with complex trauma and dissociative disorders in getting. So yeah, tell me a little bit about why it's important that you get that consistent, regular contact with a therapist.
Sure, yeah.
You and your crew, I should say, because they would all have their different reasons and needs, right? So same with our system. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So I guess I have two thoughts about that, both of which immediately disappeared. one is so I guess the first one touches on what I was just saying. I think a lot of people with complex trauma and dissociative disorders have fairly significant attachment trauma fairly often.
Mm.
And so a large part of the therapeutic process is around relearning safe attachment and relearning that you can safely disagree with someone or safely tell somebody that they said or did something that upset you and experience that, you know, like the rupture repair dynamic in a therapeutic relationship. And that takes a lot of time. It's not something you can fix in 10 CBT sessions. It's an ongoing process that takes years to establish safety in relationship. And you need somebody with very good training and skills to do that. And so that needs stability and ongoing care. And then on top of that, you know, there are very, very many of us that live in this body mind, and many of us have our own traumas that are specific to us. And at the moment, you know, like we just have to pick somewhere and start. And so, you know, we had decades of being diagnosed with treatment-resistant PTSD.
Mm.
What was actually happening was that although we were getting therapy, the one of us who held that trauma wasn't getting the therapy.
Mm.
So we weren't getting better. So now we need enough sessions. We need enough therapy to trust that all of us will get a chance to work on the things that we carry that are so traumatic and painful. And yeah, Medicare does not reflect that, you know, and the NDIS doesn't do anything to support that either. And I get so frustrated by the economic arguments around it, you know, the way the government has so intentionally been whipping the general public up into this kind of frenzy of the NDIS is full of people conning the system and it's all a rot and we can't afford it. And it's like they've actually really successfully made it okay for people to just comfortably and very publicly state that people, like disabled people, are a burden and that it's somehow unreasonable to expect that if you live in a capitalist society, which you had no choice to be born into, but you can't fully participate in capitalist structures, that it's still somehow okay to say that's your problem.
Yeah.
You know, like work it out for yourself or get over it kind of. And and that's exactly what's happening with the refusal to fund adequate Medicare and NDIS responses to people with complex trauma. It's like it often occurs to me that, you know, like if I had cancer, it would be taken as a given that I would have full access to all of the treatment I needed. But because the impacts of the abuse that I experienced and just the reality of being born autistic, you know, because those aren't things that can be so readily seen on a scan or whatever, it's fine to just deem them as somehow my problem. The economic arguments around it make no sense, because if I was able to access all of the support and therapy that I needed, that does pay off in the sense that fewer people are in a crisis state where they need hospitalization, which is a whole other nightmare to even go into, or where they, you know, can't maintain the relationships and connections that they have. So then as they age, they're reliant on public models of support in aged care and stuff, because they don't have the networks of support that they would otherwise have. It's a false economy. And I know I'm preaching to the choir there, but I'm sure you're fully aware of, like, The bullshittery, sorry,
yeah.
that goes on.
No, it's true. It's true. And, but you know what we're doing is we're getting it out there to the public what we need, and that public will include medical professionals. It will include people who advocate, like Kathy's a really big supporter of this and the Blue Knot Foundation, and she wants to have links to these conversations on her website, and that's they're a national foundation that advocates for us. So I thought we've got heaps of stuff, and I think you've contributed some really valuable perspectives on the topic. I thought we could close out with if there was something that you wanted medical professionals, whether they're mental health or just a nurse or a doctor, GP, whatever, to understand about complex trauma and dissociation or its intermingling with autism, from your experience as a person living with those things, what would you want them to know when it comes to engaging with patients who come to them with these issues?
I think it's quite a simple thing, really, that I would just like them to ask us what our knowledge and experience is and take their cues from that, instead of assuming that with the very limited training they tend to be given and the absence of personal experience, they still tend to assume that they are more expert on my experience than I am. Yeah. And that is such a barrier to then receiving proper medical care or proper support, because it's not tuned to what I need. It's not responsive to what I need and how I know myself. It's never wrong to just ask somebody.
Yeah.
And it's almost always wrong to assume that you know best if you don't. You know, if you don't have the training, if you don't have the experience.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.